Good morning. Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, February 7th, 2006. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
Coming up in this morning's news, the funeral of Coretta Scott King, widow of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., will take place today. Today is a presidential election in Haiti. And the Muslim world continues to express outrage at the publication of cartoons that are highly disrespectful of the Prophet Muhammad. Portland area weather today, fog in the morning, especially in the low-lying regions. Sunny later, highs in the 40s and 50s. Tonight, clear, lows in the 40s.
U.S. Magistrate Thomas Coffin denied bail to a Springfield man accused of setting 9 politically motivated fires that cost $11 million in damage. Family and friends of Kevin Tubbs had gathered $550,000 to post bail. They had also written letters on his behalf. But Coffin was not swayed. Coffin said, "The risk of damage to the human beings that respond to a fire is significant and can't be ignored. Arson is an extremely violent activity." Tubbs had cooperated with the government and acknowledged playing a minor role in what some have called acts of ego sabotage, said his attorney, Mark Friedman. The fires occurred between 1996 and 2001 and were attributed to the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. The trial for Tubbs and 10 conspirators, named in a 65-count federal indictment, is scheduled to begin October 31st. Assistant U.S. Attorney Kirk Engel described Tubbs as a flight risk, who told an informant that he knew how to sneak over the border into Canada should the need arise. Engdahl said, investigators who served a search warrant at Tubbs' home found 2 locked safes containing birth certificates, driver's licenses, and identification cards in other people's names.
The Bush administration has proposed slashing a program that has pumped billions of dollars into western states hurt by logging cutbacks on federal land. The plan would cut the payments, which go to rural counties for schools and roads, by half. The county payments law has helped offset declines in timber sales after logging was restricted to protect spotted owls and other endangered species. The administration also proposes to sell off some Forest Service land it considers unnecessary.
Tax season is underway, and it can be overwhelming, but for many Oregonians, the option of paying someone to help out is out of reach. Thousands of middle to low and income families and seniors are getting some help for free. KBOO's Spencer Raymond reports.
For many Oregon families, it's financially crucial to receive tax credits. But because of complex tax laws and the inability to afford professional tax preparation, many people either don't know they're available or don't know how to get them. To the rescue are some 900 Oregon volunteers with AARP Tax Aid. Wendy Genther with Tax Aid says they reach those who most need help.
We see low to middle income families that qualify for earned income credit and child tax credit, those that are on budget, and seniors that just don't have the extra money to go pay for services.
Genther says it's a very rewarding experience for the volunteers.
Most people don't know heads or tails when it comes to doing their own taxes. Tax code can be pretty complex. It eliminates their apprehension when it comes to filing taxes.
Last year, some 45,000 Oregonians across the state came to Tax Aid for help. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBOO News.
According to EETimes.com, Senators Ron Wyden and Gordon Smith have announced White House approval of a proposed Oregon Nanotechnology Center in the President's 2007 budget. This means $8 million in funding over 3 years. The $8 million in federal funding will go to the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute, ONAMI, to oversee the center. The project is expected to develop nanotechnologies for enhancing the performance of microelectronics for military applications. Possible areas of focus for the center include nanomaterials for thermal management, hybrid nanomicrostructures, and devices, transparent electronic devices and materials, and active cooling. ONAMI is a collaborative effort among the University of Oregon, Oregon State University, Portland State University, the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, or State of Oregon, and the High Technology Industry Cluster of Oregon and Southwest Washington.
The City of Portland has delayed a public forum on whether Portland General Electric rates are unreasonably high. K KBOO's Steve Casburn has the story.
Portland City Commissioners had hoped to hold a public forum on March 1st. That to present the results of an investigation into income tax payments and wholesale electric power trading by Portland General Electric. Commissioners now say a mid-March or early April date is more realistic. The utility, which is a subsidiary of the Enron Corporation, still needs to turn over extensive financial and operational data. The issue at hand? The income tax expenses the PGE recovers through customer charges. PGE was bought by Enron in 1997. Since then, it has collected about $700 million from ratepayers and sent most of the money to its parent company to cover tax obligations. Enron, however, was able to offset these PGE gains with losses from other operations. By that strategy, Enron all but eliminated actual payments to Oregon taxing authorities. In addition to its concern about tax payments, the city of Portland also has questions about the accounting methods PGE used to book some of its wholesale power trades. Commissioner Randy Leonard said he is convinced PGE rigged some of the trades to increase profits for itself or Enron. PGE officials claim that federal and state regulators have already reviewed the utility's methods and that the city investigation is unnecessary. They also say the utility has calculated its taxes and its trades appropriately and legally. For KBOO News, I'm Steve Casper.
The car chase capital of the world is going high-tech and dangerous pursuits across Southern California. L.A. Police Chief William Bratton has unveiled a strange new weapon in the police department's strategy to halt high-speed pursuits. Adhesive darts with a global positioning system that are fired at fleeing cars by police. Once fired from a patrol car, the GPS dart is designed to stick to a fleeing car, allowing squad cars to back off the chase. Bratton said, instead of us pushing them to do 70 or 80 miles an hour, this device allows us not to have the pursuit after the car. It allows us to start vectoring where the car is. U.S. Department of Justice officials suggested testing the Star Chase system in Los Angeles. A small number of patrol cars will be equipped with the compressed air launchers, which fire the miniature GPS receivers in a sticky compound resembling a golf ball. There were more than 600 pursuits in Los Angeles and more than 1,000 or 100,000 nationwide last year. Critics have long questioned the wisdom of police pursuits because they can endanger bystanders and officers.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday in defense of warrantless wiretapping on U.S. citizens, but many Democrats now question why he didn't seek congressional approval for absolute clearance. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
With opposition from some Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified without swearing under an oath of truth before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The day consisted of questions from senators.
Sorry for that. We're experiencing some technical difficulties. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday in defense of warrantless wiretapping on U.S. citizens. But many Democrats now question why he didn't seek congressional approval for absolute clearance. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
Without swearing under an oath of truth before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
We'll get back to that story once we fix technical difficulties. The funeral of Coretta Scott King, widow of civil rights leader Martin Luther King, is today. Funeral is today, and thousands of friends, family, and admirers are due to attend. This from the BBC. Today's funeral is to be held in Atlanta at the New Birth Missionary Church, where her daughter, Bernice, is a minister. Flags are being flown at half-mast at all U.S. government buildings, military posts, and diplomatic missions abroad. In the past few days, tens of thousands of people in the state of Georgia have filed past Ms. King's open casket. She is the first African-American and the first woman to lie in honor in the state capitol.
New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin is looking to other nations for help in rebuilding his hurricane-damaged city. Due to domestic failures at every level of government, Nagin has hosted a steady stream of foreign dignitaries since Hurricane Katrina hit in late August. Now the mayor says he may seek international assistance because U.S. aid has not been sufficient to get the city back on its feet. When a delegation of French government and business officials passed through on Friday to explore potential business partnerships, Nagin said, "I know we had a little disappointment earlier with some signals we're getting from Washington, but the international community may be able to fill the gap." Jordan's King Abdullah also visited New Orleans on Friday, and Nagin said he would encourage foreign interests to help redevelop some of the areas hardest hit by the storm, this according to Reuters.
For the first time in more than 20 years, U.S. nuclear weapons scientists are designing a new H-bomb. It is the first of probably several new nuclear explosives on the drawing boards, according to the Oakland Tribune. If they succeed, in perhaps 20 or 25 more years, the United States would have an entirely new nuclear arsenal and a highly automated factory capable of turning out more warheads as needed, as well as new kinds of warheads. Linton Brooks said last week at Lawrence Livermore Weapons Design Laboratory, "We're going on the verge of an exciting time." 20 scientists and engineers at the nation's two laboratories for nuclear explosive design, Livermore and Los Alamos in New Mexico, are in a head-to-head competition to offer design for the first time of the new thermonuclear explosives, termed Reliable Replacement Warheads, or RRWS. Administration officials see the new weapons and the plan to make them as truly transformative, allowing the dismantle of thousands of reserve weapons. Some worry that an accumulation of small changes could undermine the bomb's reliability. So far, every year since 1995, directors of the Weapons Lab and secretaries of Defense and Energy have assured two presidents that the weapons are safe, secure, and will detonate as designed.
Jeff Howe, who joined the Army after 9/11, and Austin Rook, a counterintelligence officer, share two things in common. Both served in Iraq, both banished from the front lines, after thousands were spent on their training, all because they preferred to have relationships with men. This according to Ross Story. Though the U.S. military continues to struggle to meet recruitment goals, gay and lesbian soldiers continue to be pushed out of the armed forces. In the 12 years since President Bill Clinton signed into public law 103-260, commonly known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, nearly 10,000 military personnel have been discharged because of their sexual orientation. Those terminated included more than 200 medical specialists and 300 linguists, many of whom were trained as much as needed Arabic translators. Though the Pentagon defends the policy as necessary to ensure unit cohesion, their seemingly selective application of the policy appears to contradict that rationale. Discharges of gay service members, however, continue to decline during wartime, raising questions about the validity of the Pentagon's defense of the policy. Nonetheless, even soldiers serving on the front lines in Iraq have been discharged under the policy, and these discharges are only one part of the story, as some personnel opt against reenlistment because of the weight of the secret they are forced to bear.
The deputy editor of a Chinese newspaper died of liver and kidney failure after he was severely beaten by police enraged by his reports in the newspaper about their work. Wu Xinghu, deputy editor of the Taizhou Evening News, was 41. Fellow journalists at his newspaper and his widow confirmed his death but refused to say anything more because of a news blackout imposed by senior officials. His wife had previously spoken about her husband's pride in his profession. One commentator said, "Such violence is increasingly common in China, and journalists are often beaten up at the behest of police or government, but deaths are very rare. Wu was beaten up in October after a report about unreasonable charges associated with obtaining a driver's license. He was asked to issue a public apology but refused, and soon afterward, about 50 police stormed his office, beat him up, and took him to the police station. The officials in Wu News Agency said that Mr. Wu's liver had been damaged in the beating. He had a liver transplant on January 24th, but died last week, just from the Times of London.
Haitians jammed polling stations today as UN peacekeepers stand out to guard the country's first presidential election in nearly 6 years, a vote widely viewed as a key step towards steering this bloody, impoverished nation away from collapse. Polls opened at 6 a.m., but voting had yet to begin at several stations in the capital. About 1,000 people lined up before dawn at a polling station in the Port-au-Prince area of Delmas, waiting for electoral officials to open the doors. Outside another polling station in the downtown slum of Bel Air, hundreds of waiting voters snaked along rutted, trash-strewn streets, some pushing and shoving to keep their place in line. The front runner is former President René Préval, a 63-year-old agronomist who led the country in 1996 to 2001. The other top contenders among the 33 candidates are businessman Charles Henry Baker and Wesley Maniguet. The field also includes a former rebel in the insurgency that forced President Jean-Bertrand Aristide from office in January 2004, and a former army officer accused in the death of a Haitian journalist. If no candidate wins a majority, the top two finishers would compete in a March 19th runoff. Hundreds of candidates also are running for 129 parliamentary seats.
George W. Bush proposed a $2.8 trillion budget to Congress yesterday for fiscal year 2007. The budget would reduce funding for non-security domestic programs such as Medicare and food stamps, and extend most of its tax cuts, and boost defense spending. FSRN's Yan Mizi has a story in Washington, D.C.
Under the president's plan, entitlement programs will lose $65 billion over 5 years. $36 billion would come from Medicare program. Medicaid and the state children's health insurance program would shed $5 billion. The White House Budget Office Director Josh Bolton says savings from Medicare program do not come from direct funding cuts.
As with Social Security and Medicaid, we do not need to cut Medicare, but we do need to slow its growth.
Ross Eisenbray is the Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute, a liberal research group. He calls Bolton's claim fundamentally dishonest.
The population is growing, and that the population of poor people is growing. You would have to have a bigger program to maintain the same level of benefits. What the president, or what Josh Bolton is saying is, no, we would just have a level program. So we're not cutting anything other than the growth in the program. But that translates into people who would otherwise get service not getting service.
In his proposal, Bush asks the Congress to make his tax incentives and tax cuts permanent. These tax reductions would cost the Treasury $1.7 trillion over the next decade, dwarfing entitlement savings. Bolton says tax relief is essential to economic development and job growth.
The most important thing we can do with our federal budget is keep a good, strong, growing economy that's generating jobs. That's the best thing we can do for those at the lower end of the income scale.
Eisenbray, again, disagree.
These tax cuts have led to the poorest job creation that the country has had since World War II. We've never gone through a business cycle with so few jobs created. In fact, the rate has been about one half of normal. We've had business investment that's been stagnant and the worst wage growth.
Both the Department of Defense and the Homeland Security Department would see major funding increases if the budget plan passes the Congress. The White House Budget Office projects a record-high fiscal deficit of more than $400 billion for the current fiscal year. I'm Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
The head of the World Trade Organization said today that all members understand that they have to give more ground on cutting tariffs and subsidies. Speaking to negotiators in Geneva, WTO Director General Pascal Lamy said there was a widespread commitment to advancing the Doha round of trade liberalization talks, according to a framework agreed on last year in Hong Kong. Negotiations to reach a treaty that would cut global trade barriers in a wide array of sectors have reached an impasse over agriculture, an issue that has dogged the Doha round since it started in Qatar's capital in 2001. Many negotiators, particularly from Brazil, blame the stalemate on the European Union's refusal to further cut its farm import tariffs. But developing nations also criticize the United States and Japan for their trade barriers. They are saying that access to wealthy nations' agricultural markets is vital to their economic growth. The WTO is also taking up the question of overcoming resistance in both Europe and developing nations to genetically modified food.
Hundreds of grieving, angry relatives of people who drowned on a Red Sea ferry last week stormed the firm belonging to the vessel's owner and set fire to the office. Desperate to know whether their loved ones were among the more than 1,000 who drowned, the relatives smashed windows, threw furniture out into the street, and set fire to a large picture of one of the company's ferries before riot police came onto the scene. Using tear gas, the police dispersed the crowd, which broke into the El Salam Maritime offices in the port city of Safaga. There are reports that some rioters set fire to tires on roads leading to the port, effectively closing the roads, but firefighters extinguished the flames. Meanwhile, in the port of Hurghada, another group of relatives broke through security barriers erected in front of the local hospital, but didn't manage to get through the gates to enter the building. Relatives of the victims have been complaining that the authorities have been slow to assess who drowned and who survived the tragedy in which the Al Salam ferry sank while sailing across the Red Sea from Saudi Arabia to Safaga. The relatives are also angered over survivor accounts of the ferry continuing with voyage for hours after a fire started below deck. There are only 401 known survivors.
Amnesty International is calling for the closing of the U.S. Guantanamo prison for terror suspects and the release of nine British residents. Nine British citizens have been freed from the Cuban camp for terrorist suspects after pressure from the British government, but Amnesty said another nine with ties to Britain were still being held. The British government has said it cannot represent people who are not British citizens. Kay Allen, director of Amnesty's British wing, criticized the government's reluctance to act on behalf of British residents. She said, "These people have become forgotten prisoners." The prison on the U.S. Navy base in Cuba opened in January 2002 and now holds about 500 prisoners from some 40 countries, many captured during the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan after the September 11, 2001 attacks. Many have been held for years without charge or trial.
Acting Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said today that he intends to hold on to all of Israel's major settlement blocks and smaller ones on the border with Jordan. It was the clearest indication yet of how Israel plans to draw its final borders. Olmert's statement defines a central issue for the Kadima Party as it heads into the March 28th elections that polls indicate it will win handily. Separately, Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz said today that Israel would establish its final borders with or without a negotiated deal within the next 2 years. This is the first time any Israeli leader gave such specific details on what Israel would keep. Olmert specified he intended to hold on to the three major West Bank settlement blocks, Ariel, Gush Etzion, and Maal Adumim, in addition to the Jordan Valley. Olmert hinted of further unilateral withdrawals like the one Israel carried out this summer from the Gaza Strip, now that Hamas won Palestinian elections and are set to take power. In recent appearances, Olmert has said that while Israel prefers a negotiated final peace deal with the Palestinians, that was not the only option.
According to Reuters, Iran said yesterday that inspectors from the IAEA will visit in the next few days to oversee the resumption of uranium enrichment. EU officials have warned that Iran's enrichment plans and curtailment of UN nuclear inspections in retaliation for the IAEA vote will exacerbate its nuclear case, making the prospect of UN sanctions against Tehran more likely. Iran says it only wants to enrich uranium to a low grade for use in nuclear power reactors, not to the high grade needed for atomic weapons, which it denies seeking. Iran's nuclear program enjoys broad support in the country, although some reformist politicians have urged the government to adopt a less confrontational approach to the issue. An opinion poll carried by the state-run Iran newspaper found that nearly 75% of the Iranian people thought Iran should press ahead with the atomic program. EU Chinese, and Russian officials have urged Iran to use the month before the next IAEA board meeting on March 6 to answer the agency's outstanding concerns about its nuclear ambitions and return to the negotiating table. Government spokesman stressed that Iran had no intention of following North Korea's example of withdrawing from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. He said Tehran will still be open to talks with the EU. He also said the door for negotiations is not closed, but they should know that this demand to have nuclear technology is not something that one can step away from.
China said today it has formally complained to Washington over a Pentagon report that calls China a potential military threat, and the foreign ministry accused the United States of trying to mislead a public opinion. The report expressed concerns about Beijing's rising military spending to project power beyond China's borders. The Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said the report made groundless accusations regarding the normal national defense development in China, interferes with China's domestic affairs, and plays up the theory of the Chinese military threat, thereby misleading public opinion. China's official military budget for 2005 was more than $30 billion, but foreign analysts say the true spending is several times that. A Pentagon report last year put the figure at between $50 billion and $70 billion. That would make China the world's third highest military budget. By comparison, Bush, in his budget proposal this week, said America's military budget in 2007 should be about $449 billion, a nearly 7% increase over 2006 for the Pentagon. That figure does not include the cost of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. China has spent heavily in recent years to modernize its 2.5 million member army, focusing on adding high-tech weapons to extend its reach and back up threats to attack rival Taiwan.
NATO reinforcements are on the way to Afghanistan to help calm the fury in over cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Three protesters are dead following a second day of violent clashes between NATO peacekeepers and Muslims in Afghanistan. In the worst violence, a doctor says protesters armed with assault rifles and grenades attacked a NATO base in the remote town of Maimana. He says they burned an armored vehicle, a UN car, and guard posts. Soldiers apparently responded with gunfire, killing three and injuring 22 others. NATO says British troops are being rushed to Maimana to secure the airfield there, and two American aircraft are on their way in case troops need to be evacuated.
The battle for water in a drought hit north of Kenya has sparked tribal conflicts, leaving dozens dead in recent weeks. And according to The Independent, the death toll is growing daily. More aid is needed urgently in drought-hit areas to prevent further violence over scarce water resources and pastures for animals. On the arid northern plains, strewn with the decomposing carcasses of cattle, people are preparing for a battle. There are plenty of weapons in the remote corner of the country, homemade spears, bows and arrows, and guns smuggled in from southern Sudan. Kenya is suffering a severe drought that has dried up watering holes and turned grazing lands into sand. More than 70% of the region's cattle have died. This is devastating to the thousands of nomadic communities that depend on them for wealth, milk, and food. As conditions grow more desperate, cattle herders have begun driving their livestock to each other's land and stealing animals to replace the dead ones.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, February 7th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO Newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. Liam Delta is on the board. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. Want to know what goes on in the KBOO Morning News? If you'd like to help out, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather for today. Fog in the morning, especially in low-lying regions. Sunny later on, highs in the 40s and 50s. Tonight, clear, lows in the 40s. Coming up this morning on KBOO, stay tuned for at 7:30, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9 on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews mystery writer Libby Fisher-Hellman, author of A Shot to Die For. At 9:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is Dr. Manning Marable, author of the new book, Living Black History. At 10, we'll speak with Barbara Rossing, author of The Rapture Exposed, The Message of Hope in the Book of Revelation, which debunks the right-wing's interpretation of the last book of the Bible. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, topics include The Monkey King by Tears of Joy and Paint Mixers by Damali Imayo. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Here is the KBOO Community Calendar for Tuesday, February 7, 2006. The End Corporate Personhood Action Group is a Portland-based group, part of a national movement dedicated to ending corporate personhood and returning democracy to we the people. Tonight will be the Information for Action meeting, where they will have presentations, speakers, and other educational events, draft and help implement legislation redefining personhood, educate the public on the subject, and more. The meeting is tonight at 7 p.m. in the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Salmon. Have you been looking for Code Pink but don't know where to find them? Thanks to, in other words, Woman Books and Resources, Code Pink is pleased to announce regular monthly meetings, the first Tuesday of each month at, in other words, new members are welcome. First Tuesday Code Pink meetings will be a chance for women to get together, meet each other, talk about agitating for peace, plan strategy, share thoughts, ideas, and resources. Come and see what it's all about. Come help make a difference. First Tuesday meetings will begin at 6:30 p.m. in the bookstore, preceded by a 5:30 p.m. vigil or street action at Killingsworth and Williams. Again, that's a street action in front of, in other words, bookstore, Northeast Killingsworth and Williams at 5:30 p.m., followed by a meeting at the store at 6:30. Oregonians for Health Security will host a town hall meeting on the future of healthcare in Oregon tonight at the SEIU Hall, 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue. The meeting starts at 7 p.m. and runs until 9. Featured guests include Senator Kate Brown, Representatives Diane Rosenbaum, and Carolyn Tomai. Speakers include Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Department of Human Services, and Maribeth Healy from Oregonians for Health Security. That's Oregonians for Health Security tonight at 7 at the SEIU Hall, 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue. Also, Allison Weir will speak tonight on the topic of the U.S. and Israel-Palestine, what the media leave out. This talk will be at St. Francis Church, Southeast 12th and Pine tonight at 7 p.m., and admission is free. For more information, visit www.ifamericansknew.org. And that was the KBOO Community Calendar for Tuesday, February 7th, 2006. Have a good day.